Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Clancy for asking me to speak here tonight. And you know, all the important people in my life go to this meeting. My son, who I love very much, my grandson, who I love very much, and a lot of men and women here that have helped me through the years, and it's just fantastic to be here and to be asked to speak. I drank for a lot of years. I went into a bar when I was 18 years old. You're supposed to be 21 here in California, but I passed for 21. You know, I was like Nancy. I was in a big hurry to grow up, and I ordered a drink, and they served me. And immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And I graduated right then and there. I never had to learn another thing for the rest of my life. You know, what else is there? If you can buy a drink, what the hell else is there? I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I just went back every opportunity I had from then on. From then on, I drank on a regular basis. I had done a little behind-the-gym drinking before that, but this is big-time drinking. You know. And I liked it. I was comfortable there. And a funny thing happened to me. My emotional growth stopped right then and there when I was 18 years old, and I dealt with the next 25 or 30 years, I dealt with life with an 18-year-old set of emotions. And that's okay when you're 18, but it gets to be a drag when you start getting in your 40s. Yeah. No wonder I was a rotten husband. No wonder I was a rotten father. And I never did reach my potential at work. I finally retired before I ever reached that. But I figure now, you know, I was 18 when I started drinking. I'm 19 years sober now. That makes me 37. That's not bad. And I feel good. And I'm sober. And it's wonderful. All I ever did when I was drinking, I just sat around. You know, I just sat around and drank. I wish I would have had a little more exciting story to tell you people, but I lived in a garage like Clint. He only lived in one quarter of it. I lived in the whole garage. You know. I'm a big time spender, you know. My wife had divorced me for the third time. And I rented this little garage place in Hermosa Beach. It was a half a block from the water. And I figured, gee, this is going to be great. I'm going to go down and run 5 miles along the ocean every single morning. You know. And then after I get through running, I'm going to dive in the ocean and swim a little bit and ride a few of those waves in. And God, I'll really feel good and I'll be ready to go to work. You know, as far as I know, the water was down there. I never really got around to check it. You know, I only lived there 4 years. I have a dual problem, like a lot of people here in AA have dual problems. They're alcoholics and drug addicts, or alcoholics and overeaters, or alcoholics and this, and alcoholics and that. I'm an alcoholic and a procrastinator. I always figure if a thing's worth doing, it's worth waiting until tomorrow to even consider doing. As a result, I just postponed 30 years of my drinking, 30 years of living. I just never got around to doing anything. And you can't blame anything on me. I never did anything. But I wound up in that shack after being divorced for the third time by the same woman. You know, I used to go to work late and come home early, and I'd sit on the edge of the bed and I'd contemplate what was going on. You know, gee, I've done it again today. You know, This can't continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. And then I'd put one of those old 78 records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" I'm drinking, I'm watching TV and playing old phonograph records and fantasizing about starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'll get down to the office about 7. I'll knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. Starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up. I'm going to mark it right on my calendar. Starting tomorrow. I'm going to work for 365 days in a row. I'm going to recoup my finances. I can devote 1 year out of my life. What the hell? A lot of people do that. They take jobs in Saudi Arabia. They go over there and work for a year or two and recoup their finances. I don't have to leave town. I can do it right here. Yeah, that's great. Sometimes I amaze myself. I have these wonderful ideas. I don't know about you people. When I've got the solution at hand, I have another drink to celebrate. And my drunkologue is really boring. I used to just sit around and drink. And I got a call one evening. And my ex-wife called and said, "Come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are." Seeing that he turned 16, he was getting in trouble at school. Nothing very heavy, just a lot of nickel and dime stuff, but it was the last straw is what it was. He went to a party and he came home drunk and threw up on the carpet or whatever it was, and so she called me and said, "Come and get your drunken son, just like you are." And I didn't want to come and get him, but what I should have said to her is, "Hey, wait a minute, you divorced me, you won that kid in the divorce settlement. You're having trouble with him, why deal with it? Don't ask me, But I didn't, I had no self-worth back in those days. She said, "Come and get him." I just went and got him, that's all. He didn't want to come and live with me. I didn't want him to come and live with me. But she said, so we had to do it, right? And he moved in with me, and then we start bashing it together, and we did pretty good. And about a month later, she moved in with us, too. And all the years I was married to her, she never drank. But one of the things she promised me when she moved in, she says, "I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you." And I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't. She was always afraid to drink. She knew she was an alcoholic before she ever took a drink. And because she was a lot like her father. And her father was a real nice guy. But when he drank, he was off and running for like 3 weeks. He'd wind up in a hospital or worse sometimes. And she was always afraid to drink. But little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period we were apart, she had started drinking. And she had crossed that so-called invisible line into alcoholism immediately from the first drink. And in my case, I think I drank myself into alcoholism. I drank for a lot of years. And it was fun. I had a good time with it. It was a social lubricant for me. It enabled me to dance and romance and do all the things that normal people seem to be able to do without that stuff. But I needed it just to get started. And I had a lot of fun with it. And I can't tell you when I crossed that line, but I did somewhere, maybe 10 years, 15 years. I really don't know. All I know is that I became an alcoholic. I became allergic to the stuff. Same thing happened to me with penicillin. I took penicillin for a lot of times. And the last time I took penicillin, I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. The doctor said, "For God's sake, don't ever take penicillin again." I said, "What are you talking about? It's always worked before." And he says, "Well, it's not going to work anymore. You've become allergic to it." And he says, "Whatever you do, don't ever take penicillin again. You really might die this next time." No kidding. I promise, I told him. I'm proud to stand up here tonight and tell you folks that I got about 28 and a half years off of that stuff. I haven't had to join any kind of an organization about it. I haven't had to get a sponsor. I haven't had to apply the 12 steps regarding my penicillin allergy. I don't even know if they got Penicillin Anonymous or not. They might have. They got every other kind of an anonymous. It hadn't been necessary for me to call anybody up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and say, I've got this uncontrollable desire to take a shot of penicillin. Seems like the allergy to alcohol is a little different than the allergy to penicillin. I just never have had a craving for a shot of penicillin. But nevertheless, I became allergic to alcohol. And after she moved in, all hell broke loose. Things weren't all that good before that, but after she got there, it was worse. Because, you see, we could never drink together. And I'd come home early and sit on the edge of that bed and drink a fifth before she got home. And when she got home, we'd have a drink together. And I was always glad to see her, and I'd pour her a drink. And as she was finishing that first drink, I'd start getting a little cozy, and she'd start getting standoffish. And by the time she finished that first drink, she was in a blackout. And all the pent-up emotions and hostilities of a lifetime would come out in that first drink. And we could never drink together. She just was not a fun person to drink with. I'm not here to take her inventory, you understand that, I'm sure, but I'm just going to tell you a few of the things that she did. It'll help you appreciate my case a little better. But she did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. She used to break my old 78 records just because I played them more than once. You know, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I'm still playing those same records that I heard in that bar when I went in there when I was 18 years old. And I got this stack of old records, and I put one of those things on. And I said, my God, what a great song. I'd play it again. And then I'd play it one more time. And then again, and again, and again. And it used to drive her crazy. She'd walk over to that phonograph and take that record off the turntable and just break it. My God, don't break that. That's a collector item, you know. Can't replace that. Good, I'll never have to hear that damn thing again. One time she just went over and took the arm of the phonograph and just bent it up. I couldn't play any more records that night, I'll tell you that. But I'd get hung up on this music. I just love to drink and listen to music. And sometimes I'd just get hung up on a trumpet toot. You know, I'd lay that needle in there, toot, oh man, that's great. Lay it in there again, you know. And sometimes I'd get her in bed. Everything's quiet and everything. I'd be playing some music. And I'd think, gee, this is a terrific song. And I'd go wake her up. And I'd bring her out in the living room, sit her on the couch so that all the stereophonics would hit her properly, you know. And I'd play one of these old records that she'd heard 1,000 times. And that's the way we lived, you know. My son would check us out, you know, and he'd go screw up my car so I couldn't get it started, and he'd take off in his mother's car. And I'd bawl him out, you know, don't ever touch my car again. Well, Dad, you look like you were kind of drunk last night. Who are you to judge how drunk I am? Don't ever do that again, you know, or ground you. I'll take your license away from you for the rest of your life. You know. Next day, do the same thing. And all he did was save me probably killing somebody or, you know, hurting somebody badly. And I'm grateful to him today. But I finally told her, I said, it just isn't working out any better than it used to work out. In fact, it's worse. So I allowed you to kick me out of all those other houses. But I moved here first. Therefore, you go this time. I'm going to go to my brother's house tonight and stay with him. And when I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you to be gone. That's more time than you ever gave me. And I went to my good brother's house that night. You know, the brother that you can go and knock on his door at 1 o'clock in the morning, and as long as you got something in a brown paper bag, you're very welcome. He'll just pull you right in. And we sat up all night and philosophized. And It seemed like his wife didn't quite understand him all that well either. And we had a lot of time to talk. But while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide again. She was always committing suicide. You know, that was another thing. She was suicidal. And she was suicidal right into AA. She had about 8 months of sobriety. Something bad happened that day. I don't know what it was. And it was serious. We know that because she was going to kill herself, for God's sake. And then she remembered she couldn't because she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night. Sometimes you wonder why they give some of us flaky people some of the jobs they give us around here. Huh? Hell, they're life-saving jobs. That's why. But that night she was going to do it. And she was in a blackout. But before she did, she went into the closet and just took a knife and slashed all my clothes. Just ripped everything to pieces. Just cut my ties in half and my shirts and socks. And even went in my dresser drawer and cut up my shorts. Took a knife and stabbed my damn shoes. Just made a complete shambles out of everything. Threw lamps and phonograph records and everything all over that little place we lived in. And just made a complete shambles out of it. And then she took the rags that she had made and put them around the doors and the windows and tried to make the place airtight. And she turned the gas on the kitchen oven and went to bed, went to sleep. She woke up the next morning, nothing happened. Same, you know. Now that old place we lived in, the wind used to whistle through those boards. You could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smell it in there. She survived again. And she looked around. She had been the only person that had been there that night. She couldn't believe what she had done. And I couldn't believe it either when I got home. Our son came home and he checked it out. He thought we were moving again. And we had hit bottom. You know, that was my bottom. I'm from a good family. She was from a good family. When we got married, we were going to live the good life. We had wonderful plans. We were going to live the good life. And all we had managed to do is just sit around and drink all the goodness out of our lives. And from then on, it wasn't good anymore. From then on, it was all bad. And this is the part of the story where generally guys say, I hit bottom, so I called AA. And everything, some real nice guy came out and took me to a meeting. Everything just been wonderful ever since. I didn't know enough to do that. I just kept on drinking. And sometimes they say I had a moment of truth. And so I called AA. Not me. Every time I had a moment of truth, I drank immediately. I cannot stand the truth. Jesus, don't tell me the truth, whatever you do. I've had 1,000 moments of truth. I drank every time. But we had gone back to group therapy again. We had gone to group therapy off and on for years. And this therapist asked me, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" And I said, "Hell yes, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't marry to a woman like that? I got two of the worst children you could possibly imagine. And this pressure job, my God, the pressure on that job alone is enough to keep a guy drinking, you know. But what's the big deal? So I drink. You know, they've never missed a meal. They've always had a decent place to stay. They've always had clothes and food and braces on their teeth. Whatever they needed, they had. So I drink. I need to drink a little bit to relieve the pressure in the evening." And he said, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, I have. I thought about it every night. You know, I'm not going to quit tonight, but starting tomorrow morning, I am." And he said, "Have you ever thought of going to AA?" And I said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already been to AA." And I had gone to a meeting one time prior to that. It was one of these meetings where they pass out chips for various lengths of sobriety. And the leader that night said, "Has anyone just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip." And here comes this guy up. My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. I know this is a spiritual program, that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. Just before I came to the meeting tonight, my employer called me, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. A wonderful, glorious way of life, and we just love everybody here. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. And I thought, oh man, you know. Anyone else? Comes this lady up. My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to be here and proud to have 30 days of sobriety, and it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life we have here. And I know this is a spiritual program, that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. It's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. I just love every single person here. Hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I just love everybody. Not just the people in AA, but everybody in the whole world. Just a short time ago, my children were failing in school. Now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States. And I'm proud to stand up here tonight and inform you people that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And these 12 wonderful steps, and all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I could hardly wait to get out of that place, I'll tell you that. I need a drink bad after all that. And so he said, AA, and I said, forget it, I've already been to AA. And some kind of a spiritual program, religious cult of some kind, it's okay for them, it's just not for me. He said, have you ever thought of, he says, so what are you going to do? And I says, well, I think I'm going to quit. And I said, I heard about some stuff called anabuse, I think I'll get some of that. And he put me in touch with a doctor, and I made this appointment with a doctor. The doctor's receptionist said, whatever you do, don't drink for 48 hours prior to coming to the appointment. And I didn't. I came there and the doctor said, is it true you haven't had a drink for 48 hours? I said, that's right. He says, you don't need anabuse. He says, you're over the hump. If you can stay sober for 48 hours, go 48 hours without drinking, you don't need anything. You're on your way to sobriety. And he just went on and on and on about the disease of alcoholism. I wasn't there for that. And he just would not stop. And he talked about people that have the disease of alcoholism have character defects. You know, and instead of working on their coping with their problems, they get drunk tonight instead. They wake up the next morning, they still got all their problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And they keep repeating this over and over and over. And he was telling me my story, but I just didn't recognize it at the time. And he went on and on. He pulled a book out from his shelf and started reading to me about how people try to control and enjoy their drinking by switching from scotch to brandy and stuff like that. And I know now what he read to me was a portion of chapter 3. And I finally said, well, if you're not going to give me any anabuse, then I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you, so I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell my patients. But due to the nature of your appointment here today, I'm going to tell you something. He says, I happen to know a little bit about alcoholism firsthand. You see, my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried everything known to medical science for her. We've tried rest homes and sanitariums, and we've tried drying out places and treatment centers and psychology and abuse and you name it, we've tried it. And it all worked for a very short period of time. You know, because as soon as she got out of treatment, then she started drinking again. And she goes to AA now, and she's got 7 months of sobriety. That's what I recommend that you do. And promise me when you leave here that you'll buy the book. You'll go to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, there'll be no charge for this call. That's the only thing that guy said that day. It impressed me at all. And And I went and got the book and threw it on my dresser, and then this fiasco happened, and she had been with me and heard what the doctor had said. She went back and asked the doctor if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know for sure, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? And so she started going to meetings with his wife. And our lives changed. To be a good guy, every once in a while, I'd go to a meeting with her. But the first meeting she ever went to, they told her, they started off all wrong. They told her that it wasn't her fault that I drank. They could have just, I had her convinced almost that it was all her fault that I drank. But no. And they said, and you can't, if you're taking credit for making him drink, it's just an ego trip you're on. You can't make anybody drink. He would have drank whether he ever met you or not. You can't make anybody quit either. We don't have that kind of power either. And so don't pour his booze down the sink. He'll just go buy another bottle. If you think you're an alcoholic, maybe you better come back to these meetings and work on your problem and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life. And she kind of liked the ring of that. So every once in a while, I'd go to a meeting with her. And I hated the meetings. And I refused to listen, by God. And I'd be damned if I still didn't get the message anyhow. It just doesn't seem to matter. When it's your turn, it's your turn, I think. And I wasn't all that happy about it, though, I'll tell you that. I tried to stay sober on my own and I did. I stayed sober from before Thanksgiving, clear through Christmas. And the Saturday night after Christmas, she went to a meeting, and I talked to myself a little bit, and I said, if you haven't drank since before Thanksgiving, here it is after Christmas, and you didn't drink through the drinking is part of the year, that proves you're really not an alcoholic after all. So I went and bought a half pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the place and I drank, and I, what the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went and got a fifth, drank it, and got another fifth, and I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday. And I woke up Monday morning, and 10 o'clock, and I'm already late to work, and I had this terrific hangover, but I had to go in. You have to go in on Monday or you're an alcoholic. I learned that right here in AA. I know that. And I went in, but I was sick, really sick, because I had poured all that alcohol into my system all at once. And so I went over to the bar a little early that morning, and I ordered a Bloody Mary, because that's what you order when you're sick. It's not really a social drink of any kind. It's just medicine is what it is. I ordered a glass of medicine. And this guy got a big tall glass and put ice in it and put a shot of vodka and tomato juice and Tabasco sauce and Worcestershire sauce and squeezed a lime and put salt in it and stirred it. I thought he'd never get the damn thing done. But he finally got it and I drank it straight down and it put the fire out. Man. But I had spilled half of it all over my tie. And I went to the restroom and cleaned that tomato juice off my tie. I told the guy, make me another one. And I went in there and cleaned the tomato juice off my tie and came back. And he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. And I went over to the coffee shop section of the bar, had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. I can't really tell you why I quit that day, and I kind of think I know now, but I think it was just my time. I think God tapped me on the shoulder and said, Hank, you've had enough for a while, And that's as good an explanation as I can come up with, because it sure wasn't anything to do with my willpower. I hadn't even thought about quitting the night before, But that was my last drink so far. And I found myself at a meeting on New Year's Eve, of all places. And 2 or 3 weeks went by, and anger set in. I had just completed about 30 years of drinking. And I had this rotten wife and 2 of the worst children you could possibly imagine. I got this pressure job. I owe money to everybody, and it's all past due. And now I can't even drink. What am I going to do the rest of my life? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. If you're anything like me, you need to drink. I need to drink. And my life is over. I'll never be able to go to a decent restaurant ever again. I'm stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. What do they want to know when you go to a nice restaurant? First thing they want to know. Would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's of a twofold nature. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one, I'll tell you that. I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. I used to spend 90% of my day back then explaining things to people. I was standing on a street corner. Somebody walked up, I started explaining what I was doing there. I had no self-worth. I had to explain just what little bit of space I was taking up. That's one of the things I'm trying to do now is quit explaining. It's hard. But I'm trying to do it. I'm working on it. And about every once in a while, I catch myself explaining. I always start from the day I was born, you know. I bring you up to date and all the ramifications and all that. And I want you to understand. Yeah. And somewhere in there I realize what I'm doing. So I stop right in mid-explanation. They never notice the difference. Turns out no one's listening to your explanation. No one wants to hear your excuses why you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing in the first place. And I'm trying to quit altogether. But it's not easy. Unless you think it's all fun and games, it isn't. You know, AA is a serious thing. It has a serious side to it. And I hated AA the first 6 months I was in it. But I got a sponsor after 6 months, and I'm really glad I did. Because a sponsor, if you get a good sponsor will insist that you work the steps. And my sponsor did. And because you never know when the chips are going to come down. And you need the 12 steps as a replacement for booze. And you need these 12 steps as a platform of life. Something to draw from when the chips are down. The chips came down from me about 8 years ago. And my wife and I had moved up to the desert. And we were going to retire up there. And she came to my office one day and she said, doctor just told me I got cancer. And I got 2 or 3 months to live. I thought, geez, you know, I couldn't believe that. So I went to a meeting that night. What else do you do? You know, you go to a meeting. That's what I was trained to do, you know. You go to a meeting. And I went to a meeting. And that night, they read last couple of paragraphs of A Vision for You, which they do at a lot of meetings. And it was like, I've heard that read 1,000 times. But it was like the first time I ever heard it. Because they say, you know, ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the person who is still sick. You know. Obviously, you cannot help anyone unless your own house is in order. And I heard that. And I didn't quote that exactly right. But when I heard that, it really had an impact on me that night. And I realized that I had been working this program right. That I had done something right in my life. Because you see, my house was in order. Our house was in order. And all the things that needed to be said had long been said over those years. My wife and I had some good years in AA. And she sponsored a lot of women. And we had some real good years in AA. It was a turbulent marriage, to say the least. But we did have some good AA years. But when I heard that Vision for You, that part of Vision for You read that night, I knew that I had been working the steps right. I knew that I had worked this program properly. And I felt good about it. Because, you see, I was able to be of some help to her. and I had devoted my time to helping her, and she lasted 5 years. In the last 6 months, well, she didn't even know me hardly. And but you know, when she passed away, I can stand up here tonight and I can say that I don't have any guilty feelings, because you see, I was dependable by then. I was able to be of some help to her. I don't have to say, God, if only I would have done this, if only I would have said that, I should have done this, I should have done that. No, I don't have that. I don't have that guilt. I feel real fortunate for that, because now I'm faced with a decision after she died. What should I do with my life? I can mope around and get a lot of sympathy, you know, or I can choose to live. And I've chosen to live. And the people, and the men and women in this room, a lot of them helped me join the living, come back to, you know, I had dealt with death for so long that I didn't even know what to do. And I was helped a lot by the people here in this room and in AA. Everything I knew for sure turned out to be all wrong. And I went to a nice restaurant just the other day. And they asked me, would you like a drink before dinner? I said, no thanks. And it didn't even faze her. She just went over to the next table and asked them, and they did. They're always drinking over there, you know. I'm the only guy in the whole restaurant not drinking. And but every once in a while, I'll look over at that next table. There'll be a well-dressed couple. And they'll be sitting there with a martini in their hands. And they'll be clicking their glasses in some kind of a toast. It'll be an anniversary or a birthday or something. Every once in a while, after 19 years of sobriety, every once in a while, that still looks good to me. You know, my God, you know, I've still got the disease of alcoholism. You know, you're not dealing with a well man here tonight, I'll tell you that. I've not been cured. And, but you know, I know what to do about it. You know, I know that what I'm going to do when I die is I'm going to leave my brain to science. And let them study my brain, because they can see what a real alcoholic brain looks like. And when they get it under the microscope, they'll look, oh yeah, they can see all that. And then they'll put it down in that solution, you know, that alcoholic solution that they... And when that brain hits that alcoholic solution, it's just going to go crazy. And it'll go for 2 or 3 minutes, and finally it'll calm down. And I'm sure if you put your ear down there close to that glass, I'm sure you'll hear it say, ah. But you know, until then, I'm going to go to a lot of meetings. I'm going to call my sponsor all the time. I'm going to read the big book. I'm going to speak anywhere I'm asked to speak. I'm just going to maintain my sobriety. Because, you see, I want to be sober more than anything in the world. My sobriety is the most valuable thing that I've got. And 19 years ago, I thought my life was over because I couldn't drink. Now I know if I drank, my life would be over. And I'm very fortunate to have AA. You know, my son's sober here in this group. And he got sober. And my grandson, my daughter's son, is here. I don't know if he's here tonight, but he's in AA. He's coming up to 4 years. My daughter and my daughter-in-law both send you greetings from Al-Anon. And we're an AA family. We weren't any kind of a family 19 years ago. And believe me, we're not the best family on the block right now. But we've all got the steps to work if we choose to work. And so I'm very happy to be sober tonight. And about the only kind of a message I can give you is the message that I heard when I went to my first meeting. And that's it. You know, I found out that this is really a spiritual program. I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of this place. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turned me on. Thank you very much.